which is on the topic of the use of peers in these online courses, both for things like peer grading and peer assessment, as well as for peer teaching of each other. And the first talk is going to be by Scott Plummer. So Scott is a faculty at Stanford University in the computer science department, although he will soon be moving to UC San Diego. And Scott taught an HCI course online through Coursera recently, which of course is interesting because a lot of the types of problems that the students dealt with in the course were not ones that could be easily graded in a multiple choice or other standardized manner. So Scott is going to share his learnings from that with us.
Thank you all for coming back after dinner. As many of you know, I have a background in design, and I'm a huge fan of the teaching methods that design as a discipline employs. And I'm going to give you a really personal narrative of my experience with a number of different assessment methods in design classes. And the personal flavor seems really appropriate for an after-dinner talk. I originally wrote in my speaker notes that I was going to give you a sober assessment of the successes and failures. And I think one of the core methods of design teaching and learning is the use of the studio method. And the studio in design teaching comes from the founding of the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris in 1819. And it's endured for about 200 years. So you fast forward about a century later to the Bauhaus in Germany in the early 20th century. And most sort of classic art schools that you see in America and Western Europe follow the pattern that was developed at the Bauhaus. And this is me. They had three different physical locations. This is the Berlin one a couple of years ago. And I think art and design education can teach us a lot about how to structure physical space. This is a photograph I took of the product design loft at Stanford. And one of the things that I like about this space is you've got, you know, Barbie dolls and upside-down umbrellas and just stuff all over the place. And so if you want to know what your peers are up to, if this is your studio space, 2 seconds and you know what's going on. When somebody changes direction or learns something new, you know what's going on. If you want to know, who should I ask about bending fiberglass or glue guns or anything else, you can see that. And so the visibility that you get in a physical studio is incredibly powerful. And interestingly, I think computer science used to be this way also. I was an undergraduate at Brown, and I couldn't find a picture of when I was there, but I'm in between these two eras. And everybody was in one room. And so if you wanted to know, what are you going to learn next year? Yeah, Zoran's in this picture on the left, actually.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mary might be on the right. And so what's really nice is you want to know what you're going to learn next year, it's there. You get a seg fault and you're stuck, you can turn to the person to the left and you can get some advice. And there's an incredible cohort experience. A lot of my best friends are still from this time. And I think we've lost that. The worst thing that happened to computer science education is cheap laptops. Because cheap laptops mean that everybody scurries into their dorms. Many students tell me they still work collaboratively, but it's cliques rather than everybody in the same space. So I started teaching at Stanford in 2005, and in the winter, Bill Verplank and I taught a design studio class. Bjorn was actually in the class back there. Wendy Jew was the TA, she's somewhere in there. And in this class, one notable feature of the student evaluations that came back was the how fair is the grading question. The course was rated in the 13th percentile. And my education came back from an art school, and so my feeling was, wow, the amount of feedback we gave these students was so much better than I ever got at RISD. These ingrates don't know what they're talking about. But, eventually I changed my mind. And I had a really interesting experience where I tried several experiments in the next few years and was able to inch that number up. And I do think that part of the issue is that being in an engineering school, the expectations for what is fair are very different. And that was underscored for me when I went to my reappointment meeting with our deans. We got talking about teaching, and the assistant dean says, wait a minute, you mean that your assignments are subjective? And he was totally horrified. And thankfully, my colleague Terry Winograd was there, and he's like, you mean like this meeting? And I think terrifying. Because what he's trying to say is that a lot of the most important kinds of assessment that we do are of subjective things, where the answer isn't B or C or D, but what you're really trying to do is figure out what matters and what's important. But still, I think there's a long way we can go in terms of making grading fair. And in the summer of 2009, I got really interested in self-assessment. And if you are or would like to be, this is a fantastic book that I highly recommend. So here's the physical class that I teach online. Dan Weld talked about the phylogenetic tree of AI classes. I think that if you did the same thing for HCI classes, you would find that James Lande's class is probably the root of a lot of these. And so this is a project-based course where you go through the whole user-centered design cycle. And I think that there's a bunch of things that are interesting about this class. 160 students from 22 different majors. Very cool. And I think one of the important roles that design plays in a computer science or engineering curriculum is it's the one place that we teach problem finding as well as problem solving. And so when we introduced self-assessment, one of the things that we did, not at all novel, most of what I'm not going to talk about is novel, even though most of it was new to me, is we created grading rubrics. And so these help students be able to assess their own work. And so the weekly ritual for my class in the physical world is each Friday at 8 a.m. we have an assignment due. You go to a 12 to 15 person studio, and then at the end of studio, you open up your laptop and you assess your own work. It's important that you do it there, otherwise you'll run off to the party and totally forget about it. So this is our current ritual, and then later that afternoon, teaching staff gathers together and grades everything you want. In addition to the physical co-location, so I can see what each of my peers are doing in the studio, which is a great way to get a feedback of, am I slacking or am I working well or how else might I have done this? We've worked with John Mitchell's courseware system so that all of the assignments that students post are write only up until the deadline and read only afterwards. And in the Facebook era, students absolutely look at each other's work. Now, I got nervous when introducing self-assessment. My goal was to say, if students assess their own work, the ideal outcome would be that everybody just gets their own grade. There are two worries you could have here. Is that one is that students will say, I get an A+. And another one is that they would say, I'm not that good, I get a D-, when in reality they did pretty well, and both of those seem fair. So the algorithm that we currently use, I won't claim it's optimal, just we've been trying it the last couple of years, is you get your own grade if your self-assessed score is close to your TA assigned score. And if they're different, if they're notably different, you get the TA grade. And if you think about this for a little bit, one student came up to me after lecture one day, mad as hell, and he said, this is a total injustice, I can't believe this is so wrong, because what you could do is students could give themselves like epsilon above what they've actually earned, and you would get an unfairly high grade. And so I shared this with the class the next lecture, and I said, one student was really worried about this, and if you have such an incredible intuitive skill of knowing exactly what your TA is going to give you, that every week you can give yourself epsilon above what they're going to give you, and you hit that maximum every week, that skill will be so valuable in your life ahead that I'm more than happy to give you an epsilon bump in your grade. And so what happened with that? So we had a 91% correlation between the self-assessed scores and the staff-assigned scores, and 69% of students on any individual assignment got their own grade. And this goes up over the quarter, so it tends to be lower at the beginning, and it tends to be quite high at the end.
Scott, you say 91% correlation?
0.91 correlation.
0.91 correlation, but what was the slope? Was it 1, or was it...
You know, if you plot them, it kind of goes up like that, and you see things in both directions.
Was there a consistent, assessment?
I've looked at this and I tried to grab it when putting this talk together and couldn't find it again. Well, how about this? High-performing students, on the whole, tend to underrate themselves, and low-performing students tend to overrate themselves. This is consistent with all of the literature. And I think one reason that you see for this is, so what's interesting is that while the on balance, the average TA score and the average student score are about the same, but the variance of self-assigned scores is narrower than the variance of staff-assigned scores. So the bozo students say, I did pretty good. They're deceiving themselves, or maybe they just don't want to face the music. And the superstar students, they're hard on themselves. And so they said, I did pretty good, but not great. I could have done better. And that's one reason, I think, why they're doing so well.
By the way, is another reason possibly motivation, that these students that underrate themselves always try harder?
Yes. One of the reasons why I think the best performing people do so well is they hold themselves to extremely high standards.
Yeah.
And I think all of us have had times in our life where we've held ourselves to really low standards and we're like, why does everybody think I'm such a schmo? And other times you're like, I don't get it. Why is everybody else, you know, not taking this so seriously? And I think that the one incredibly valuable role that self-assessment plays is it holds up a mirror to what standards do you hold for yourself and what are the broader standards that are being envisioned. And I think you may still decide that you're going to hold yourself to an extremely high standard.
But it's different. I'm asking you, might turn out that you said standards. Might turn out that people think that they're performing terribly and then work extra hard. It's not the same thing as holding to a high standard. I know someone who's very, very bright who never thought he actually got anything. He's extremely bright. So I thought to myself, wow, there's a metacognitive notion of understanding where you decide that you must be well enough to know it, but it's probably not well enough to somebody else. And these people who think they can't get anything have these brilliant, deep understandings. So it's a matter, I'm saying it's something deeper than just higher standard.
Yeah, some of it falls into what do you count under the umbrella standard, but that's probably a longer question.
Right.
There's a bunch of other universities that use these materials, and it's been interesting to talk with those that are using the self-assessment materials. Some are and some aren't, about how that's going. And I had an opportunity this past year to think about putting my class online when the first batch of Stanford classes was going out. Andrew asked me if I wanted to put the HCI class out. And I said, you know, I'm not quite ready yet, but I'll do it this coming winter and spring. And one of the things that was interesting was thinking about the limitations of multiple choice. And one thing I've learned is that multiple choice questions are much more powerful than I first thought they were. And designing good ones is really hard. That said, as David Carter pointed out, as Wim Fanon pointed out last night with Rosetta Stone, multiple choice is way tacky in comparison to broader free response. And so we settled on a technique called calibrated peer assessment. I learned about this particular technique from Ed Hutchins, who uses it in his anthropology class. And in the HCI online class that we taught, as Andrew alluded to earlier today, you would grade five of your peers, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. And that meant that you got five scores from each of your peers. And the score that was assigned to you was the median of those five scores. We just sort of made that up. And it was fun to design this with Daphne because we'd have these long meetings where we would start out with something extremely simple. And like two-thirds of the way through the meeting, we would have an eight-layer Bayes net that was going to do something incredibly fancy. And then we realized that we wouldn't be able to reason about its failure modes, and we had no idea how well it would perform anyhow. And so we would go back to the simple thing. And we did this for about 6 weeks straight. And I keep coming back to this simple median of five. In the coming days and weeks, I hope to do some analysis of how well this would have worked. Could you go four? Could you go three? Stuff like that. Could you do something fancy? So we launched this class online. It was really fun. We covered about half the topics of my Stanford class, and it has the same video lectures and other stuff. I recorded pretty precisely and spoke pretty quickly, which I don't normally do, but I tried to thwart the people watch at double speed because I think sounding like a chipmunk for an entire quarter seemed too appealing. And so we'll see how that goes. I think the best strategies are still open here. I'd be happy to talk more about my video recording setup offline. I had a couple of innovations there. People were asking about numbers, so I pulled some quickly. 31 unique videos, a little more than 400 total minutes of video. Took me forever to record, as in I was in the lab till midnight every day for most of spring quarter. I'm not at all convinced that the quality was better for it, but it did take a long time. And don't believe Andrew Ng when he tells you you just walk into the room, hit the go button, and you're done. I think part of that is Ken's point about experts are notoriously bad at estimating how long it will take novices to do stuff. And part of it is that Andrew's just a liar.
Why? We're shooting a 20-minute video. Why does it take so long?
Because if you have the opportunity to record it with no deadline, you'll say, that wasn't the best way to explain what's happening. I should learn a little bit more about that. And so the way that it would normally work is for a 15, 20-minute video, I would work on it for a couple hours. Then I would hit the record button. I would record for about 2 hours straight, one take, because that made it easier for the particular video editing software to produce ScreenFlow, for those that are curious. But most of that video is me just thinking or looking stuff up on the internet, or fixing slides, or whatever.
It's got them on uncut, right?
Oh, with my TA's headphone.
It's probably great data for somebody who wants to study how professors author courses.
And oh lord, is it not that interesting?
Were you faster at the end?
I got a lot faster. Okay. And also, it's a weird medium to get used to, which also, I'll talk more about offline. So we had quizzes and all that other stuff and a forum and assignments, and we made the rubrics better. And we had this peer evaluation system, which I want to get to the punchline, so I'll fast forward through this because Andrew talked about a bunch of it. I think one thing that's not unique about this class, but I think is interesting, is the most common crowdsourcing model is, hey, Turkers, can you do this stuff for me? And what I think is interesting about the online class is that there's a group of people, each of whom is helping each other. And the community feel of this model of collaboration is importantly different than the online delegation model. And in particular, you get a real benefit in terms of the empathy and student engagement. And it automatically scales, which is really nice. And it works best if the community is really enthusiastic. Jennifer Whittem told me, don't worry about
people. How does that scale? I mean, if there are 100,000 people, how do you develop a sense of community with anyone?
The scaling I was talking about in particular was that the I grade I get scores from five people scales automatically. The community for 100,000 worked far, far better than I would have ever thought. If you just scan the forums, you'll get a sense of the strong community there. Jennifer told me don't worry about cheating at all, and that was really fantastic advice. And so to sum up the differences between the online and the in-person one, we got about half the material in about half the time. You get a statement of accomplishment. You could get an apprentice accomplishment for watching the videos and doing the quizzes, or a studio statement of accomplishment if you also did all the projects. So the way that it worked is you have assignments due weekly, and then at the deadline, 11 p.m. every Tuesday, my TA would log on 11:00 and grade 8 to 10 examples, which would then serve as the training examples for the students to do peer assessment. And the calibration part of this is that you grade the same ones as the TA grades, but without seeing their score, and then you get feedback on how well you did. And the hope is that you get more calibrated over time.
Did they do anything special to pick those 8 to 10 examples?
Not really.
Like choosing, for example, from those scoring students in the previous assignment?
You know, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, we didn't do anything fancy anywhere, half intentionally and half because we were overwhelmed. We did try, like, in eyeball terms, we tried to get a range of abilities, like, if the roll of the dice gives you 10 A's or 10 D's, you know, they would pick a different one. But that's really it. Yeah, Lydia.
Did they grade it together?
I had TAs sequentially because copyright, accessibility, and other issues pushed, and developing the peer assessment system, pushed our launch date back. And so Robbie graduated June 17, and Chinmay took over. David.
This is because I've done a lot of work with that in the past. 5 works fine if the flaky graders are equally likely to prefer upward or downward. Is that what you saw, or do they tend to always grade high or always grade low?
Hold that thought.
Okay.
All right. So
another question.
Yep.
So if the students had to first grade up to 5 assignments that the TA graded and then grade another 5, wasn't that a little excessive?
The grading workload is not low. Each student had to do a fair amount of grading. Many believed that that was really valuable.
Yeah,
many also believed that it was burdensome.
Was it 5 or 10?
So 10. You did, I forget how many people we had do in the training phase. We had 8 in case you did badly on the first couple. So we had a train to mastery strategy. And so once you did well in the training phase, you got let out into the broader garden. And if you did badly, then you went through more examples.
So we have been hearing about the fact that 50% or 60% don't even submit the first assignment, and then very few actually eventually make up to the end of the course. By having a peer-graded assignment, there's a lot of emphasis on the peers actually being serious and putting in the effort, because otherwise some other student who is very serious hurts, and that hurts their experience. So what did you find in terms of the participation of these somewhat more casual and non-very serious students?
All right, so all of the numbers that you hear for these online courses are more misleading than they are useful. Because the big giant number that's like 1,200,000 students signed up for my class really means 1,200,000 people type their email address into a field, which is staggering. But that's not at all the same thing as took my class. And so what we had was, what is notable is that if you have, how many people watched at least one video for this class, so I just cut off the type their email address in because I think it's a bogus number. But if you said watch at least one video, that's a pretty big number. And 7,000 submitted at least one quiz. And to Mawson's point, 2,500 completed at least one assignment. And so, you know, the 27,000 people that did not cannot peer grade. In order to be allowed to peer grade, you need to have submitted the assignment. There's multiple reasons why we did that. You can guess what they are. And we had 800 complete all 5. We had weekly assignments, which was a stupid idea in retrospect. If you have in-person students, weekly works great. If you have people who have families and travel and lives, weekly deadlines just don't work. And so when we roll out the course again in the fall, we will probably space that out more. We had 10,000 people fill out the survey. Came from 124 countries. Yeah?
I'm sorry. Can you just elaborate on that? Because is the weekly, because I had actually come to the exact opposite conclusion, possibly doing this myself, and thinking that one did want to have weekly assignments, but making sure that they weren't too big. Is it?
So, there are 2 deadline strategies for an online class. One is, well, 2 basic ones. One is a hard deadline strategy where we say, after Tuesday at 11 p.m., you're out of class. There's just no submitting it after that. The other one is a soft deadline strategy where we say, you can submit after Tuesday at 11, but we'll dock you some points. And if you have a soft deadline strategy, short, fast assignment deadlines are great because people don't do it until the last day. But if you have a hard deadline strategy, it is totally true that on any given week, somebody's grandma is going to be sick and somebody else is traveling. And so for hard deadlines, rapid fire doesn't work. Barbara, did you have
okay. Can I quickly re-ask
sure.
my question? So, out of the 800 people who actually did these assignments regularly, or the 2,000 who actually submitted some, were there cases where people gave the assignments on time but did not really grade on time, which hurt the overall productivity of the system, of the grading process?
Great question. So assignments were due Tuesdays at 11 p.m. Pacific. The peer assessment was due Sundays at 11 p.m. Pacific, I think, a couple of days later. And you did not get credit for submitting an assignment unless you submitted the peer assessment. People of all ages. And Mary, given all of the questions, you should just tell me to stop talking at some point. I won't feel the least bit bad. But the questions are more exciting than the content. So They do lots of different stuff. There were all these meetups.
Was that self-employed? Was your big...
Yeah, I've got... My hunch is that there were a lot of young stay-at-home parents. People transcribed at least some... So Coursera contracts with Amara to provide transcripts for the videos. Videos, not all of them were translated into all of these languages, but at least one was translated into each of these languages, and that was done by the students in a crowdsourced fashion, which is pretty cool.
So, going back to the occupations, and you said there were a lot of stay-at-home parents, one thing I've been wondering about all these lectures is what were the gender demographics like? I'm wondering if you get more women in these classes than in traditional computer science classes?
So we had 10,114 people fill out the survey. Of those, 3,113 were women. So that's a one-third women rate, which is slightly higher than my in-person class. And both of those numbers are significantly higher than the other computer science classes in their cohort.
Okay. Do you have a sense for the link between some demographics like gender and completion?
That would be in the data, and we have not yet looked at it. Here are study groups from all over the world. That was totally one of the most rewarding things about the class. It was really fun to watch the forum just come alive as soon as the class launched and have people doing a Belarusian study group and a Catalan study group. I don't even know what the Hungarian one says, and they seem to be having a grand time.
Do you know if there are actual physical groups?
Yes, so we had ten meetup.
Actually getting together.
So in these locations, people were getting together on a regular basis. And Andrew showed you a photograph of a San Francisco meetup from my class. So here's some graphs and some things that happened. So you heard from Jennifer and Andrew about Amy Cunningham. The course launched on my birthday, and I woke up that morning to my email, and one of my emails was from Jane, who is the shepherd of all the online classes. She's really the person who makes all of this stuff happen. We had Amy, which was great. Here's some assignments that people did. So this is from Russia. This is a need-finding assignment. Here's one from Spain that was a need-finding assignment. Then they moved on. We used Balsamiq for rapid prototyping. Again, Russia and Spain. People create implementation plans for the same assignments. Then they go out and do user testing. They did a really great job. The quality was extraordinary.
Do they test online or in person?
We did sort of small-scale usability testing. In my Stanford class, we actually run A/B tests online and get into controlled experimentation and online testing a little bit more. I may do a follow-on chunk of this class that includes more online.
So the lectures got translated, but the assignments were all due in English?
Assignments were only available in English. Why we didn't translate them, I don't know. And it was required that people submit in English. We didn't make that clear enough for the first assignment. We got stuff back in all languages. One open question is...
Interesting.
I really want to, as an experiment, allow Spanish as a second submission language. There's a huge number of Spanish speakers in this class. And Coursera's not quite ready to do that, but I kind of want to convince them.
Was that the second biggest language?
So, yes, you can have the Spanish students grade each other. That's exactly what I'd like to do. I think the best way to go with all of these things is baby steps, and so I think introducing one more language would be the next step to do. And Spanish for my class was by far the second largest language. I may have country data in here if we get that far. Peer and self correlate pretty well. You do see that there are a whole bunch of people who self-grade 100 where it's not reasonable. But that's not as flagrant as you might wonder. I was really worried about doing this peer grading at scale. I took it to be just an enormous risk that was probably going to blow up extremely badly. And in fact, we held off releasing most of the assignments for the class until we saw the first one, because we were going to change everything if it went badly. And I kind of thought it would, but Daphne and Andrew, in that case, gave me a lot of courage to try it. And it worked pretty well. And if you compare them, there's a pretty strong correlation, and more than half of the students, even in the online class, are receiving their own grade, which I think is super cool.
So I have a question about this, and this came up in Andrew's talk also, where he showed this diagram of the previous study, where he showed the correlation, and correlation is great, but there we are talking at a global level, we are talking at a statistical level, and we say that in general the trend is good. But think of an individual student who believes that he has or she has done good work, but the grade that they received, in sometimes in fairness, is actually much lower, and it may be much higher also. Does that lead to, you know, bad experience? Is there a mechanism in place to improve it? You know, and did you see these cases? I mean, there are lots of questions in and around this, because statistics, to me, just doesn't cut it.
Sure. So, for me, the most interesting number is, for a pretty tight threshold, half the students are receiving their own grade. So that says half the students and their peers are spot on in agreement. Now, you could flip that around and you could say, but the other half are not. And I think what I was really surprised by is I was ready for a good fraction of the class who was going to be real cranky about their grade. That did not turn out to happen. There are that many people who are cranky about their numerical score. There are a much larger number of people who are cranky about the fact that they didn't get more qualitative feedback, which, given the language diversity issues, we limited the amount of qualitative feedback that students could give to each other.
So what percentage of the students need to start behaving badly for your resources to be overwhelmed? 10%, 20%, that they grade themselves 100 and then they yell at you about it. Where is that threshold for you?
I don't know, and I'm sort of an empiricist on this one. I think in these classes, if you had a large number, or even a modest number of rogues, you could beat them. And my sense is fight the fires as they come up. Dave?
A pair of short questions. First off, I just realized, okay, you're doing this grading, but at the end, it's going to be a certificate of accomplishment, right?
Yep.
So that their grade matters. I mean, if they got their certificate.
People care enormously about their grade, even though you could argue it doesn't matter. And I'll give you a data point for that. On one of our quizzes, for reasons that I still don't understand, Chinmay Midstream changed one of the quiz questions, and it switched which answer was right. So for the first chunk of students, B was the right answer. And for the next chunk of students, C was the right answer. This is one of these things like, in the fog of war, you make a dumb mistake. The amount of venom that went onto the forums about that inconsequential change in grade, it's hundreds and hundreds of pages. And so if people are that bent out of shape about a single quiz question, and they're not about this, and I've had the same experience in teaching my ACI class at Stanford, where I expect that one of the major things that people are going to weigh in on is some sort of evil around self-evaluation. And they don't even notice it. It's the, you know, in lecture 7, there was a typo on the slide. So it's pretty interesting. Here's some interesting...
when you give them their grade, do they nevertheless see the TA or the peer grade? And
what do they see when they receive their own grade? For both my in-person class and online, we've talked about a bunch of different options. And I'm not sure what the current implementation is. It's an excellent question.
Do you get a letter grade, a percentile? Do you curve it? You know, those things matter to students.
Yes, they do, enormously. At the end of the class, if they're above some threshold, they get a statement of accomplishment, which says, you did the ACI class, you scored X out of Y.
I guess this is where you have to hold my previous question about the median. So what's the median, the right thing? Where the students biased up so that you should say take the second highest instead of the median?
Yeah, well, so you're exactly right that this was the graph that I was holding it for, and it doesn't really answer your question because it only shows the median score on the y-axis. It doesn't show all five. I was hoping to get, I thought you might ask that question given that we did this analysis for the CHI data several years ago. And so I was hoping to have that answer for this talk, and it, that one didn't happen yet. Andy.
So just to add some data to that, I do a lot of peer assessments in my class just in the same way. And the problem is actually more simple tendency. So even though you have some people that are getting the talk, really nobody can get a good score.
It's the same regression to the mean as when you have 12 CHI reviewers on your paper. Yep. All right. So here, this was fun. How much did you feel you learned by assessing others' work? So Likert scale, lots. Little people learn lots from assessing others' work. How much did you feel like you learned from assessing your own work? Still strongly headed this way, but less so. So I take that to mean that people felt like they learned a lot in assessing other students' work, and I think that that's absolutely true.
Do you have a sense for, though, they could learn a lot from looking at other people's work, independent of whether they assess it? I think they're both interesting.
Yep. The number of controlled experiments you could run in this domain is huge, and I've got a list of them, and we've done none of them.
Just to interrupt for a second, in the interest of time, if you have, like, let's keep, like, 2 more minutes worth of stuff, so you can decide
Great.
If you want to take questions or if you want to present more slides, it's up to you.
We'll do questions till the end, and that's fine. Okay. Interestingly, and perhaps unsurprisingly, a clever question that Chinmay put in the quiz, or Jane put in the quiz, was... how much effort you put into assessing others, and how much effort you thought the person on the other side of the table spent assessing you. And, the people taking our class are human. They believe they put lots of work into it. They thought their peers put lots of work into it, too, but less than they did. A really cool one. So, inspired by some research that Pam Hines has been doing on cross-cultural perceptions of design, Chinmay decided to look at, we don't tell you what country the assignment you're grading is from or the name of the assignment you're grading, but even though you're blind to country of origin, you may be able to infer it in various ways. Do you grade assignments from your own country higher than others? And the answer is yes, robustly so, and even if you hold out any of the usual suspects, like you can include the US or not, you can include other large countries or not, and this trend continues. We don't know cause, but I think it's really interesting. So I'll pick one last slide to show.
Do you think that's specific to HCI design?
I don't know. I mean, this is just like weird thing that happened.
That obviously hurts your idea of doing same language grading because you will have more and more correlated scores which are pushed up in some direction if you have more language grading because of this.
Sure. The really interesting direction for future work is how do you clump the peers? And there's lots of strategies. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll take future questions after Bjorn and Rob get a chance to talk. I was amazed by how much DIY there was by students on the forum, not only by Amy Cunningham, but by lots of students. One example is... one student took all of the readings I recommended and put this up as a resource for everybody. So for each of the lectures, you can see all of the readings that I refer to in the lecture. You may get a couple of bucks from Amazon for doing that. But it's pretty cool. And here was Amy on the eve of the first assignment deadline, peer deadline. We had way more.